The U.S. is working to reestablish normal relations with Cuba. As part of that, the country raised the flag last week at the reopened U.S. Embassy in Havana. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Senator Jeff Flake, who's long been calling for the end of the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. I'll also ask Senator Flake about why he's decided to oppose the nuclear agreement with Iran. And what does he make of the role immigration reform is playing in the early stage of the 2016 presidential campaign? Also, Northern Arizona University President Rita Chang arrived in Flagstaff in 2014. We'll talk about how her first year has gone and how higher education is changing in Arizona in the wake of state budget cuts. Plus, in the spring, Phoenix New Times released a top 10 list of things the Valley's arts community needed to do. Phoenix Art Museum played a prominent role, and there have been some significant changes there recently. I'll ask Becky Bartkowski of New Times about them. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. State utility regulators are letting Arizona Public Service pursue a higher monthly fee for new rooftop solar customers in advance of a full rate review next year. But as KJZZ's Dennis Lambert reports, Tucson Electric Power will have to wait for its next full rate case to ask for changes that would cut savings for rooftop solar customers.
The Corporation Commission is telling Tucson Electric that it not only has to wait for the full rate case, but in the meantime, it can't tell customers there's a cutoff date when they may face higher rates. The Arizona Daily Star reports TEP wants to cut the excess energy credits it gives rooftop solar customers, but has withdrawn its proposal after the commission's staff and solar advocates opposed the idea. The issue will now be heard in a full rate case set to be filed by the end of the year. But the commission also prompted TEP to alter a disclaimer about potential cost increases for solar customers, because some say it has reduced demand for solar installations in the Tucson market. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Navajo farmers in northwestern New Mexico have rejected some water delivered to tribal communities after a mine spill, saying the tanks holding it appeared unclean. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says the water, trucked from Bloomfield, New Mexico, met all federal and state water quality standards. A crowd of mostly farmers gathered Monday night in Shiprock to address the water quality. The trucking company says the tanks and trucks were clean and has no reason to believe the water is unsafe.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Kathy Ritchie. The city of Phoenix has chosen James Bennett as its new aviation director. Bennett had served as CEO of the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, which includes Reagan and Dulles airports. He also served as Sky Harbor's assistant aviation director from 1988 to 1996 and oversaw the construction of Terminal 4. Bennett will begin work on October 5th.
We should see sunny skies today in the valley, high near 106, and about the same tomorrow. The high is expected to be 106 again.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, offering a wide range of Subaru-certified pre-owned models with standard factory warranty up to 7 years or 100,000 miles. Shop Subaru.com.
Skies are mostly sunny right now in Phoenix, and it's 96 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Northern Arizona University President Rita Chang arrived in Flagstaff in 2014. We'll talk about how her first year has gone and how higher education is changing in Arizona in the wake of state budget cuts. Plus, in the spring, Phoenix New Times released a top 10 list of things the Valley's arts community needed to do. Phoenix Art Museum played a prominent role, and there have been some significant changes there recently. I'll ask Becky Bartkowski of New Times about those. We start today's program with U.S. Senator Jeff Flake, who's been right in the middle of national policy on Cuba and the Iran nuclear deal, and he joins me now. Good morning, Senator.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So big times going on in Cuba. You were not a lone wolf on that, but to some extent you were. How significant is the restoration of relations?
You know, this was what a great moment that was to have the three Marines who in 1961 lowered the flag. Who committed to be back to raise the flag soon after, 54 years later, they were there, near 80 years old, to see it raised back up again. And that just, it was an incredible moment, it really was.
What was wrong with U.S. policy before? What didn't make any sense, and why did you think it needed to change?
Where do you start? You know, we have the object of the policy all along, obviously, was to change the government, you know, to remove the Castros. The Castros have outlived 11 U.S. presidents, and they're still there. That's the biggest thing wrong with the policy. It simply didn't work. And second, it just, you know, it infringes on not just, you know, it's just not bad policy. It infringes on the rights of Americans. As an American, I ought to be able to travel wherever I want, unless there's a compelling national security reason. And there hasn't been, and yet Americans have been prohibited from traveling. And when some people say, there's still a communist government there, why are we making concessions? It's not a concession to allow your own citizens to travel. That's not a concession at all, nor is it a concession to establish diplomatic relations. That's an agreement between two countries to talk and use diplomacy. And so that can be hardly viewed as a concession.
What about the human rights concerns? You alluded to that, where people say, again, the Castros are terrible people.
Right. There are big human rights concerns and big problems there still. I just believe that we'll be better able to press our concerns when we have full diplomatic relations. We've had these concerns. There have been abuses of human rights for decades now. We haven't been able to stop that without diplomatic relations. And with the current policy, I think we stand a better chance of influencing the Cuban government with diplomatic relations.
Is there something about Cuba, because it's so close to our own coast, that people take it more personally? Because it feels like there are a lot of countries we deal with that have some of these similar concerns.
Yeah, I think we do. It's 90 miles off our shores. We have strong cultural and other ties to Cuba. And so, it's been a big issue, and obviously there are other concerns as well. There are property issues that still have to be resolved. The people who have family members still in Cuba, this hits them personally, and I understand that. I would say that, over time, whereas among Cuban Americans, most of them used to support the policy of isolation, they don't now. Overwhelmingly, Cuban Americans favor allowing Americans to travel freely and diplomatic relations. So there's a few holdouts still, but by and large, people support this move.
You've been in the world of politics for so long. Do you think opposition to this is completely legitimate, or is some of it that, we need to look tough? Some people are running for president. Some people just don't want to act as if they're going to have anything to do with the Castros.
Well, I don't want to question the motives of those who favor the policy that we've had in the past. I think some of them genuinely feel that that's the way to go. I just think that they're wrong on this, and I'm glad that the president has decided to turn the page. And there are still things that need to be done. Only Congress can lift the travel ban completely. The president can make changes on the margins. But with the embargo as well. I think I've said for a long time, we ought to say to the Castros, we're lifting the travel ban, we're establishing diplomatic relations, and if you don't stop these human rights abuses, we're going to lift the whole embargo. And so, I've never seen that as like I said, some kind of concession to them, but rather as a get-tough policy, because a few dictatorships, particularly 90 miles off our shore, can survive when Americans are traveling and trading freely with them. This embargo, or as they call it, the blockade, has been their scapegoat for the failures of socialism forever, and they continue to use that. So if we trade and travel freely with them, they'll have no excuses anymore, and I think we'll have a much faster transition to democracy than we would have otherwise had.
So finally on this, since there's momentum building for this, do you think Congress will move to support this?
I do. With regard to travel, and that's what I've been mostly concerned about, there are many categories now available for Americans who want to travel to Cuba. What I think you're likely to see in the next couple of months is a broadening of that as well, and most importantly, people-to-people contact. There's talk that the administration may move and make that a what's called a general license category, so somebody wouldn't have to be part of a group that's traveling to Cuba for people-to-people contact. They could just decide on their own. That coupled with, I think, a coming agreement in the next few months between Cuba and the U.S. on a civil aviation agreement that will allow not just charter flights from cities like Los Angeles, potentially Phoenix, and others to Cuba, but scheduled service, where somebody could use frequent flyer miles on American, for example, to go to Cuba. Once that happens, combined with the lifting restrictions on people-to-people contact, then it's essentially over, and it'll be more of a formality when Congress rids us of this travel ban.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with U.S. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. Compared to many of your Republican colleagues, you were kind of sort of hold out for a while on the Iran nuclear proposed agreement there. You've ultimately decided you're going to oppose it. Why are you going to oppose it, and why did you give it consideration? It seemed like you were actually trying to figure out whether it was worth supporting or not.
Well, I've supported these negotiations all along. I think that we ought to negotiate with countries sometimes that we disagree with. President Reagan certainly did that with the Soviets, and look where we are. It was a good deal. I had hoped to have an agreement that I could support. When it's an agreement this big and this important, you ought to do due diligence, and that's why I've taken a while. We held a number of hearings and briefings, classified and otherwise, leading up to just last week. The week before last, we had three or four briefings and hearings, and so I wanted to make sure that I attended those and availed myself of every opportunity to learn more about this agreement. I mean, this included meetings with the IAEA, the group charged with inspecting the facilities, discussions with former diplomats, discussions with the president, with the National Security Advisor Susan Rice on the way to Africa a few weeks ago, and most recently discussions one-on-one with Secretary Kerry on the way to Cuba last week. I wanted to give the opportunity, the administration, every opportunity to clarify some of the issues in the agreement, and I wasn't successful in getting them to do that, and so I didn't think I had a choice but to vote no.
Is there any degree to which this is something that I can only ask you? I can't ask you to represent the party, certainly. But is this an issue that is just so difficult? I interviewed Jimmy Carter a few weeks ago, former President Carter. And, of course, he was president during the time when we all saw the Ayatollah on our TV screens.
Right.
I remember being a kid there, and it was terrifying in a sense. And there's part of me that wonders if there's still that overarching fear of what Iran had done to the U.S. three decades ago, and whether that, I'm not saying people like the negotiations, I'm not saying they like the final product, but do you think there's any part of that where we still consider Iran to be part of that axis of evil? We can't trust them at all, even if there's that sort of mix in there.
Well, I think you don't need to look back 30 years. You can look more recently at some of the behavior in the region. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the president, when this agreement was negotiated, he said, you know, we're gonna get an agreement on the nuclear side. There are other issues still out there, notably Iran's behavior in the region, supporting other terrorist groups and, you know, through proxy wars and everything else. But we'll deal with that separately. There's something to be said for that if you can truly separate them. But I would argue that this agreement doesn't truly separate them. On the nuclear side, with regard to the known nuclear facilities in Iran, this inspection regime is pretty good. We will have, you know, 24-hour access on some of these facilities. It's the suspected sites where covert activity may be taking place. It's a little sketchier, and the inspection regime is a little less robust. But still, on the nuclear side, I think Iran has less incentive to cheat big, at least, because we have other ways to find out. I mean, we can view under this agreement their whole supply chain in terms of nuclear nuclear, you know, ingredients, and we can tell, you know, on a number of ways if they're trying to break out. I think there's little incentive for them to really break toward the bomb. Let's keep in mind, they've been close for years. They could have taken this next step. Mm-hmm. They've had the resources and the knowledge to do it, to you know, the last breakthrough to having enough, at least fissile material for a bomb. But they haven't chosen to do so because I think they feared the reaction of the West, both in terms of a potential military strike, but also these sanctions were biting and biting hard, and they need to rid themselves of some of those. And so on that side, I think there's not as much incentive, but I think there still is every incentive for Iran to behave badly in the region. And we ought to be concerned about that as well, not just on the nuclear side.
Is there potential for this to make the White House look bad and in turn make the country look bad and have Iran think that actually this might give them more influence if we see all Republicans and a pretty good chunk of Democrats opposed to this.
Yeah, I don't relish the look of that. I mean, if I was putting on a partisan hat, maybe you could say, you know, this president is just naive and he's gone into this and every Republican is opposed to it. But frankly, I think that's a bad thing for the United States and for our prestige abroad and for our ability to work with our allies. I don't like to see a big, broad agreement like this pass with just a plurality of Democratic votes. That's not good for us. And so I had hoped that it would be something that that I could support. In the end, I had too many concerns that this tied the hands, this agreement tied the hands of Congress to respond to Iran's nefarious activities in the region. And I could not, I think, had this been a treaty, and that's the direction we probably should have gone, we could have clarified those problems with what are called RUDs, or reservations, understandings, and declarations. Those are passed whenever you pass a treaty, and then and it allows the Senate to say, here's our understanding of what this treaty means. That was desperately needed in this case. For example, if Iran shot down a U.S. or shoots down a U.S. plane, 2 years from now, hypothetically, would we be able to respond by imposing sanctions on their central bank? Those are the sanctions that really bite, that really mean something. And under this agreement, it's not just questionable, it says we can't. And certainly Iran interprets this agreement as prohibiting us from doing so. And that we could have clarified with RUDs, and it would have provided good deterrence for Iran in terms of its behavior in the region. But since it's not a treaty, it's just an executive agreement, at least we could have had parallel legislation which says, here's our understanding of this agreement. But I couldn't get the administration to even support that. And so I in the end, just couldn't support it.
That's U.S. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. After this break, we'll have a few more minutes with the senator. We'll talk about immigration reform. And we'll find out what he thinks about Donald Trump running for president. That's as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by Homestead Senior Care, serving the Valley since 1997 as a source of non-medical in-home services for seniors, from scheduled personal care to continuous Alzheimer's care. Info at homeinstead.com.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. A reminder, we've got BBC NewsHour coming your way today at 1. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now, on the Pima section of the Loop 101 freeway, there's a crash blocking the northbound shoulder at Cactus Road. Sunny skies across most of the state right now. It's 94 degrees in Tucson, 95 in Casa Grande, 97 in Yuma. Under sunny skies, 86 degrees in Prescott, and it's 79 in Flagstaff. Well, are you tired of your old car and want a new one with the latest options and better reliability? When you get that new model, why not donate your old one to the programs you enjoy on KJZZ? We'll send you a tax receipt and tow it away for free. Just complete the easy form at cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. Mostly sunny skies in Phoenix, and it's 96 degrees at 11:22.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with U.S. Senator Jeff Flake. Senator, 17 Republican candidates for president. Issue of immigration reform has come up again, but sort of all over the spectrum. You were part of course, the so-called Gang of Eight for comprehensive reform.
Right.
Donald Trump is saying some things. Lindsey Graham, who's part of the Gang of Eight, sort of saying things in the opposite end. Is it good for this issue that it's out there like this, or is it making sort of a cartoon of it?
Well, it's good for this issue to be out like this now instead of next year. So I hope that this talk of building a wall that have Mexico pay for it or some of the things that Mr. Trump has said are a distant memory by next year. So there is value in having it come up and be dismissed early on.
But are voters going to dismiss it? Will voters hear that and think, not a bad idea?
I hope that I think that there are a number of voters who right there with Mr. Trump. I just happen to think it's a smaller number than Mr. Trump thinks. And as we get into 2016, when the vote actually gets closer and people Republicans consider we not only need to win a primary, we've got to win a general as well. Mm-hmm. I think we're ready to move on from some of this very divisive rhetoric that he's used in terms of, you know, those who come across the border and what they mm-hmm. do here. But not just that, but to have a serious policy in terms of what you do with the 11 million people who are here now. What is rational? What will work? And what is just red meat thrown out, you know, every couple of years that really bears no relation to reality?
The proposal that you were involved in, very multi-pronged. It right. certainly had border security involved, but had other aspects, whether, I know you'd supported a guest worker program for a long time. So right. again, it almost feels like it's tabula rasa again, now that we're out there, and it's almost like the plan that you and the other seven had put together was forgotten. Even Marco Rubio doesn't even really acknowledge his support quite as much, perhaps because he's running for president. So how difficult does it make it, let's say if Trump's words are forgotten next year, how difficult does it make it to actually put a plan together again?
Well, I think when we get me on, Mr. Trump, there are a number of candidates who understand the complexity of the issue and can offer serious solutions about it. Marco Rubio is one of them. I worked with him on the Gang of Eight bill, and he was very instrumental in making sure there were tough border security provisions in there, but also workable guest worker program. He understands this issue well, as does Governor Bush. John Kasich does as well, and many others. So I think that as we get, with fewer candidates there, when there are 17 candidates, somebody with 20% can lead the whole bunch. Mm. But that 20%, I think a good portion of that number, when we get into next year, will think a little differently. And two, that's simply not enough to win a primary, let alone a general.
One more quick question on this topic. So Ben Carson was in the state today, yesterday as well, but today with Paul Babiaux and touring the border and whatnot, Donald Trump toured the border. Do these border tours actually teach people much, or does it seem like more of a photo op?
No, I think that they are instructive. For example, when you go down to the border and actually spend some time on it, not just in one site, you understand that this notion that we're going to build a 2,500-mile wall and make the Mexican government pay for it or not, just the notion of a wall and that's where all the resources ought to go. Obviously, we need better barriers. It needs to be a wall in some places. It needs to be a fence in other places. It needs to be a vehicle barrier in other places. But it's a more complex situation than sometimes we want to admit. And then also, if people spend time on the issue, they realize that, nearly half of those who are here didn't illegally sneak across the border. They came legally and have overstayed. And so you need to deal with that issue as well. And that's why once you start, getting through these issues, you realize it's very tough to solve the issue just by talking about the border itself.
Let's close up the conversation by talking about money. Certainly you've been against pork barrel spending for many right. years when you were in the House, certainly in the Senate as well. Now that you're a senator and not having to run for office every couple of years, I wonder what has changed for you in general? Because I know people, when it comes to the House, many people get annoyed that they seem to hear from their member of Congress constantly. It's almost like the entire 2 years you're sort of looking to raise right. money again. Is money the specter over politics that many outsiders think it is?
I obviously, as a candidate going through this last election, 2012, with outside groups playing in with big money, that was the kind of it's unnerving for any candidate because, there was probably $40+ million spent in my Senate race. I raised and spent close to $10 million of that, but the rest of it was either spent by my opponent or largely by outside groups that my opponent didn't control or people on my behalf that I didn't control. And so I think, less and less control of your own message, and that's a little unnerving. But the so-called remedies that some people put forward, public financing, always tend to favor the incumbent, and they're not good for anybody but the incumbent. And so I tend to say, it's certainly unnerving to go into it, but I don't know of a better solution right now.
And finally, once you're in, though, even if you didn't have control over those groups, do those groups expect to get more time with you because of that?
Obviously, those who contribute to candidates want access, want to be able to, you know, want you to take their meeting when they come in. We take all meetings. We're going around today, town hall, and we obviously have office hours, and money. It's never fun to go out and raise money. I'm not wealthy on my own. I can't fund my own campaign, so it's a necessary thing that you go through. But in some ways, it's essential as well. You get out there and let people know what you stand for, and people will gravitate to that and typically support you financially as well. So, for all its faults, it's still better than the alternative.
U.S. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. Senator, thanks for coming in.
Right, thanks for having me.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The state's three public universities are welcoming their undergraduates back to campus this month. Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff begins its fall semester on August 31st. Rita Chang has been president of NAU since August of last year, and she joins me now to talk about her first year and other things. Welcome. What is NAU's position in the realm of higher education? I know we like to avoid labels, but is there a label or a category into which NAU fits?
NAU is a regional university that's gone national in its reputation for student success and research in highly focused areas. So I would say that we are an undergraduate serving research institution that has very few peers.
And do you see that? Is that the track on which NAU, at least for the short term, can and should remain?
Yes, our goals are to continue to provide accessible and affordable education opportunities to Arizonans, to fulfill our commitment to our students to provide an exceptional education experience. While we increase our research contributions not only to the state but to the nation and the world and seek extra dollars coming in to support those activities, and we can do that because we're uniquely setting in Northern Arizona, helps us have really strong partnerships and a commitment to providing that workforce that will advance the economy of the area and also for the state.
How do you see NAU's place among Arizona's other institutions of higher learning? Primarily, I guess I would say Arizona State and U of A, but there are some other offerings now that had not been there in recent years.
Clearly, the public universities provide the majority of the educational opportunities for citizens of the state of Arizona. And my colleagues at the University of Arizona and ASU and I are committed to continuing to have an enterprise system that monitors access, affordability, and provides an exceptional education. We are not the only providers of higher education in Arizona, but clearly we are the most prominent, and we provide choices for families to access a wide variety of degrees and majors, and I have really enjoyed the opportunity to work with my colleagues to advance education in Arizona.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with the president of Northern Arizona University, Rita Chang. President Chang, how have state budget cuts at this point affected NAU?
Well, clearly it was a bit of a surprise to come in my first year and have the significant cuts to our budget that had to happen due to the economy of Arizona and the lack of flexibility in new revenue sources. So we have had some challenges, but we have worked collaboratively not only across the campus but across the public university system in addressing those budget cuts in a way that does not adversely affect families and students. I think that on a positive side, the revenues to the state are coming back, and that deeper cuts are not going to be necessary, so we can start the conversation around restoration for some portion of those cuts, and we will then continue to see a thriving public university system in Arizona.
Do you think there's a disconnect in terms of the role of higher education in Arizona, and is that about getting a stronger message across, or is that about some state leaders not quite getting the message?
Many higher education institutions across the nation are facing budget challenges. I have been encouraged by my conversations with members of the House and Senate and with the governor and his staff, because they do understand the importance of education to the future of Arizona. At the point in time last year when the budget needed to be cut, there weren't a lot of choices. As the economy turns around, the first priority that I will have is to continue conversations of not only about NAU, but about higher education in general, and how the elected officials can help us to restore our funding, and that we can work in partnership, because we are so important to that economy.
You mentioned restoring the funding, and let's say there is some restoration, but there were very deep cuts, obviously, for a number of fiscal years when it came to university funding in Arizona. How will higher education change? How must it change because of less financial commitment directly from government sources?
Well, change is always a part of the conversation for higher education. Higher education has become a very competitive environment. Students have many choices, as do our donors and our partners and our granting agencies. So it's always important for us to streamline our processes, to maximize our existing resources, and look for ways to do things better. The university, however, contributes significantly to the economy of Arizona. And so as the economy grows, so can the university. As an example, NAU alone contributes nearly $2 billion every year to Arizona's economy. Our 20,000 students on the Flagstaff campus and are complemented by 8,000 students off the Flagstaff campus, that the majority of which are living and working in southern Arizona. So it is really important for us to have the conversation about the state's contribution, but also to know that our students graduate, they get good jobs, they contribute to the economy, as do our employees, and we want to be part of the solution, not a problem for the funders of the state.
Is this a situation now where universities are forced to be innovative because you really don't know what's around the corner as far as funding?
Yes, and that is a challenge and also a great opportunity, an opportunity for us to examine how we've done things in the past and whether or not we can continue with the same procedures and practices. We've found ways to streamline through the use of technology, our advising and our admissions process. We've found ways that we can use technology in the classroom so that learning can take place not only in the traditional lecture, but also in the online versions of the class support systems. And we have found ways that we can ask ourselves whether departments can collaborate and maybe consolidate efforts and have a better impact.
Is it stimulating, but at the same time a little daunting to realize that, yes, there's something new, there's something innovative, and we're going to be at the cornerstone of it, but also you really may not know how things will work out. You sort of, in some ways, just have to try new things.
Yes, and one of the things that I think this environment has really made an impact for universities is that we are now reaching out to partnerships with our communities in a more significant way. An example of this is in Flagstaff, the city and the university collaborated to develop a business incubator, and most recently that incubator, NASAT, has also helped with a new accelerator. And so those are examples of where in the past the university might have thought that they needed to do this on their own to accelerate ideas of their faculty out to the public. And here we're doing it in collaboration.
Rita Cheng is just starting her second full year as president of Northern Arizona University. President Cheng, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Dan Hunting of ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy about legislative redistricting in Arizona. And then later on this hour, Becky Bartkowski of Phoenix New Times on changes at the Phoenix Art Museum. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Ballet Arizona, presenting Coppelia, the comic tale of an eccentric toy maker, life-size dancing dolls, and a young couple in love. October 29th to November 1st. Tickets at balletaz.org.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and online at kjzz.org. Well, a lot of sunshine for the valley today, a high near 106 degrees, a couple of degrees above average for today, about the same for tomorrow, the high again 106, and we've got a slight chance for some showers on Friday evening. Taking a look at valley traffic right now on the surface streets in Scottsdale on Via Linda, just east of 91st Street, an accident is blocking the middle lanes there. We have Here and Now from Boston coming up at 12. The militant group ISIS has killed a prominent Syrian archaeologist. We'll hear what his death may mean for the study of Syrian history. And kids in China are getting their first taste of American-style summer camp. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon. It's mostly sunny right now, 96 degrees in Phoenix at 11:40.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision on Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission was focused on the drawing of congressional districts, but the IRC is also involved with mapping legislative districts, which receive considerably less attention. But Dan Hunting, senior policy analyst at ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy, says more focus should be put on legislative districts when maps for the 2020 elections are put together. And Dan Hunting joins me now. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's wrong? I know that it's probably a long list, but what's wrong with the current makeup of legislative districts from a voter standpoint?
Well, we have many voters in this state live in districts where they do not have really a full choice of representatives in the state house. Every Arizona voter is represented by three people at the state house, two representatives and one senator. And our districts are aligned such, they are so heavily weighted towards one party or another that many people don't have a full slate of candidates to vote for because one party or the other simply doesn't run candidates in that district.
Now, turnout for legislative elections is so poor. Do you think better drawn, more competitive districts could change that?
Well, I think it could, but I think this is actually sort of distanced from that specific issue. I think this gets down to those that do turn out. Even in a low turnout election, many voters in a heavily Republican district, if those are Democratic voters, they don't have a choice of any Democrats to pick from in that district. And the same goes on the other score as well.
Dan, what do you think? I know it can be hard because we're going to have a new commission and whatnot. What does it take to make these changes a possibility? Is it changing demographics? Is it members of the committee sort of see, you know, we really could make this better for the state?
Well, the committee has a pretty good list of guidelines to go by for setting up the districts. Now, there's obviously some discretion in there, and there's quite a bit of discussion about what is fair and what is not. The last redistricting in 2010, there was a lot of attention placed on the congressional districts, the nine congressional districts in the state, and I think they were largely successful in that case because we had three or four of our congressional elections that were very closely contested in 2014. That's not the case with our legislative districts. We've got 30 districts there, and those generally are not well contested at all.
You made the point in a piece you wrote for the Arizona Republic that there's so much focus on the congressional elections, and yet those are nine people who, based on sort of other factors, could impact our lives in major ways. But of course, they're also impacted by, in some cases, 426 other people, whereas the legislature is focused on Arizona issues and there are 90 members. Do you think, is it just going to take more effort to get that into people's heads that people down at the state capitol might actually impact their lives more?
Yeah, I think maybe people are starting to become aware of this with things like, you know, tax issues are always front and center in people's minds. Education issues. We've got a lot of discussion about whether or not we're funding our education at the level we should in this state. And those issues are made at the State House. They're not made in Washington, D.C. They're made here in Phoenix, down on Washington Street there. So I think as people get more aware of these things, I'm hoping that they will realize that the State House bears a lot of attention.
Dan, not a lot of other states have independent commissions, but have you noticed any pattern? It does seem that, I presume, certainly congressionally we've seen it in other states. From a legislative standpoint, have you had a chance to do research to see whether they're as gerrymandered as Arizona?
I have not looked at that yet. That's an interesting topic for discussion, but I have not gone into that very deeply.
So the legislature in Arizona has been primarily dominated by one party. How much do you think that overall has affected the situation and whether there's energy to modify the districts?
Well, you know, part of the problem, of course, is that the Democrats, for instance, if we're talking about a place like Chandler that tends to be heavily Republican, the Democrats aren't going to waste a lot of energy in putting in a candidate there that is probably going to lose. But even in that case, even in a case like Chandler, it may be 60% Republican. There's still 40% of those people are Democrats, and they deserve some sort of at least say in what's going on. The other thing that happens when districts get so heavily polarized to one degree or another, the only people that make it through the primary are the most extreme on either the left or right. And so if we had better representation, I think we would have more moderate candidates in general.
Right. Six of the 30 state senators, you wrote, were put into office effectively by one vote each. And the end result is that 20% of the senators really needed no vote other than their own to clinch their election. It's really striking.
Yeah, that's right. If you don't have a primary opponent and you don't have an opponent in the general election, you can just vote yourself in. And I think that's probably not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind when they came up with the idea of American democracy. I think that most people would agree that competition for the seats breeds better representation.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Dan Hunting, senior policy analyst at ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy. We're talking about more emphasis being put on Arizona's legislative districts by the Independent Redistricting Commission. Dan, I don't know if this is in your purview, but it interested me thinking about the makeup of the parties and the gerrymandering of districts. There, of course, was an effort to have a so-called top two primary for statewide offices. I wonder, what do you think about a top two primary for legislative districts? Even if we ended up with two members of the same party, perhaps we'd get a better way of looking at who actually represents the district and who the voters would want.
I think that's an interesting idea. I'm not completely sold on it, but I think it has some promise in there. The whole idea of primaries, especially when we have such a large number of voters that are not registered with either primaries, they're independent voters. We need to draw those people into the primary election somehow, and this might be a good way to do it.
So safe districts, of course, it's a very pejorative term in many senses. How much, I don't want to say blame, but I guess I'll use the word blame, do we put on the parties deciding, well, we only have so much to invest, and why even bother with this particular district or another?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some of that, and it's got to be really hard if you are a candidate, you know, in a downtown Phoenix district that is a very heavily Democratic district, and if you're a Republican saying, I'm going to run in this district just to get my name out there and to put the name on the ballot, knowing that your chances of winning are pretty low, that's not a very encouraging thing. So in a way, you can't blame the parties for doing that. But I think if we drew our boundaries a little more equitably, there would be less of that going on. There would be, even in those heavily Democratic or heavily Republican districts, the minority party would at least have a shot at getting in with a candidate.
Dan, there's also the feeling among some that with what's going on with these districts, that clean elections had an issue with that, because clean elections made it easier for some people to run, but there was also the feeling they would actually make it better for the system because people would have to knock on doors to get contributions. Is some kind of reform like that, something like that, maybe not clean elections, but something like that, is a grassroots effort in some sense the way to go?
Yeah, clean elections is interesting. It's kind of an unintended consequence situation there, where people thought, well, let's have clean elections. We'll have essentially publicly funded elections because we're going to get the business element out of the elections. That the perception was that the fat cats in the you know, smoke-filled rooms were choosing the candidates at that point. Well, it turned out that some of those business interests put a restraint on what candidates could get elected. And so I think we've seen several fairly extreme candidates get elected because of clean elections. So we really need to rethink that, and especially in the line of the super PACs, where now the whole table has been upset as far as funding
Dan,
for elections.
Dan, one final question for you. Do you think that we're seeing a parallel with the legislature and with Congress and the divide that we tend to see across the country, this idea that in many cases, I think we saw it in Congress with members, Republican members from the Northeast, who tended to be more moderate, and Democrats went after those seats and in many cases got them. So we're seeing very hardcore Republicans, very hardcore Democrats. It seems like we're seeing more of that in the legislature as well. Overall, is that an issue, and would that potentially be helped by less gerrymandering?
I think it would be moderated by less gerrymandering. That would allow people in the primaries to get through that were not the most extreme candidates. I think that's what we've got going on right now.
Dan Hunting, Senior Policy Analyst at ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy. We've been talking about the legislative redistricting, and you can read Dan's piece. It was in the Arizona Republic over the weekend. Dan, thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. There's been a long-running debate about the Phoenix arts scene that includes questions like these. Are venerable arts organizations too conservative? Are their patrons too conservative? Is this an encouraging or discouraging place for young artists to blossom creatively? Those are some of the topics we addressed back in March with Amy Silverman and Becky Bartkowski of Phoenix New Times when they published a report on the state of the arts in the Valley. Phoenix Art Museum got some prominent attention in our conversation, and last week it was announced the museum's media relations team was being let go. Becky Bartkowski wrote about that and joins me for a few minutes with an update, primarily on Phoenix Art Museum. Becky, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Phoenix Art Museum has a new director, Amata Cruz, took over for the longtime director, Jim Ballinger. Maybe I shouldn't ask you for a grade, but what are some of the big changes Amata Cruz has made?
Well, the most recent changes is that we've had, 16 staffers leave in the 6 months since she's been director of the museum. She's been there 6 months. She took over for Jim Ballinger, who had been there for, he was director for more than 30 years. So just a massive culture change, people leaving to take bigger and better positions, a few people being let go. So that's been the big change we've seen, a lot of turnover.
I guess we naturally see that when someone new takes over, as you mentioned, for someone who'd been there for three decades. Are you getting any buzz based on, is she attracting more attention? Is she attracting more money while at the same time feeling like, hey, we're going to just sort of change the culture?
She has attracted more money. So Bud and Suzanne Selig donated $2.5 million to the museum shortly after Amata came on board, and that money is being used to fund a new chief curator position, a position that actually they've just announced they filled this week. And they're combining the position with the contemporary curator position, one that's been vacant for nearly 2 years, actually. So big, big changes, big announcements.
Well, that was on your list, I remember, back in the spring, of getting a contemporary curator. Why is that? Remind us why that's so important. And any insight as to how this sort of hybrid position is going to work?
Not a lot of insight into how it's going to work. But the new curator, he'll oversee all of the other curators on staff in addition to the contemporary art curation program there. It's important because it's a great way of tying into the local community and people who are making art currently. It's something we've been without for 2 years at Phoenix Art Museum, and I think the museum has really suffered for not having a contemporary art curator.
Well, and the young woman that you and Amy, I remember, mentioned at the time quite prominently is doing interesting things over at SMOCA. Do we know about some of the people who are coming into the Phoenix Art Museum? I mean, do they have good reputations? Can you tell us about them at all?
Well, there isn't a whole lot to go on at the moment as far as people coming on board. Gilbert Vicario, he's coming from Des Moines. He has a good reputation out there as a contemporary art expert. And then we've got a new education director coming in. I think she actually started this week. Her name's Kayla Hoskings.
Right.
And she comes from Art Pace in San Antonio, which Amata Cruz previously ran before coming to Phoenix Art Museum. So a little bit of a connection there, and we'll see. We'll see. She's brand new. So.
And it's interesting, too, with Amata Cruz, and then, as you mentioned, bringing the new education director from San Antonio, it was a much smaller place, though very impactful in what it was doing. And Phoenix Art Museum, do you feel like it's changing from what critics would say was sort of stodgy into something that might combine having great exhibits with the more contemporary? How important is that for a growing city like this?
I think it's extremely crucial. And, you know, in the past 6 months, we have seen some very interesting collaborations come about at Phoenix Art Museum. A local literary journal, Four Chambers Press, they collaborated with the museum to release a collection of poetry and prose based on works on view at the museum. Really cool project. I definitely recommend checking it out. And also, we've seen more recently on First Friday, dance companies come in and perform throughout the museum. So there are definitely some interesting things happening, things that weren't necessarily happening before Amata came to Phoenix Art Museum.
The story you wrote last week that was online at phoenixnewtimes.com was about the media relations team changing. And I guess, does that fit into the same category of just personnel changes, or is there something that goes into doing media relations for an art museum? Maybe what Amata Cruz wanted that was something different that was being done before.
Well, what I'm hearing from my sources is that Amata's not really accustomed to having a media relations team. So over at Art Pace, there was not in-house PR or marketing. Mm-hmm. So there were maybe some growing pains there. And apparently she did not gel with her marketing team. So yeah, they were reportedly let go last week. Two of them were. And then another member recently quit. So currently, there is one member of the marketing staff left, and she is a graphic designer, and she's pretty new to staff. So she is part of this whole sea change.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Becky Bartkowski of Phoenix New Times about some changes at Phoenix Art Museum. Becky, when we think about Phoenix Art Museum, we could put Arizona Theater Company, I guess, in there, Desert Botanical Gardens. When you have, a growing community like this, how important is it to have sort of those anchors? Can it be sort of the rising tide lifting all boats? Can these anchors get in the way of what a vision for a community can be? Based on the writing and reporting you've done, how can they work? How can the big dogs work with sort of the up-and-comers?
I think it's crucial to see these big dogs work with up-and-comers. I mean, Ballet Arizona is going back to Desert Botanical Garden next season. It's very exciting. I think Phoenix Art Museum reaching out to more and more local people who were maybe a little bit more part of the Grand Avenue or Roosevelt Row scenes, bringing them into the museum space is really meaningful, especially because they bring with them their audiences. So it brings new eyes to Phoenix Art Museum and also brings new things to the people who are regularly at the art museum. It's a really nice balance, and I think it's really important. Yeah.
When I introduced our conversation, I said that, you know, Phoenix has had this sort of reputation among some for being too conservative in many ways when it comes to the arts. First of all, do you think that was true, and do you think that's changing?
Well, I mean, the arts in Phoenix are such an interesting and complicated kind of scape. We're seeing so many changes at museums, at SMOCA, at Phoenix Art Museum, and at the same time, we're seeing big changes at Roosevelt Row, galleries opening, closing, developers coming in. It's a really exciting time to be paying attention.
Are we seeing that diversity of interest, I guess, too? Because I think for a lot of people, they want to see the arts community of not just, again, big companies with small companies, but maybe more traditional museum goers or arts goers sort of mixing with people who want something a little bit different. Are we seeing that dynamic?
I don't know if we're seeing it as much as we could be, but it does look like we're moving in the right direction as far as that goes.
So any final thoughts based on 6 months ago, what we talked about? Are we seeing some changes you'd like to see sort of generally in the artscape?
As far as from 6 months ago, I think we are already seeing so many changes that we're going to need some time to digest all of them. I'm very, very much looking forward to the chief curator coming in at Phoenix Art Museum, seeing what he brings to the table. I hear he'll be joining the museum in October, so something to look forward to.
We'll have to talk about it then. Becky Bartkowski, Phoenix News Times. Thanks, Becky.
Thank you.